Our first speaker today is Jennifer Briggs.
All right. Hi. Thank you all for coming, and thank you for inviting me to speak. This conference has just been fantastic so far, so I'm really thankful to be here. I am a PhD candidate at the University of Colorado Anschutz Medical Campus in the Biomedical Engineering Program. And my title is way too long in the program, so I retitled it Complexity Theory, Diabetes and Vascular Care, and our Heart Posture Toward God. So I want to start, this is my first time being able to start a presentation with a Bible verse, so that's fun. But I want to start with 1 Samuel 16:7. But the Lord said to Samuel, "Do not look at his appearance or at his physical stature, because I have refused him. For the Lord does not see as man sees, but man looks at the outward appearance, but the Lord looks at the heart." And I underline this part because I think that's what's really essential. For the Lord does not see as man sees, for man looks at the outward appearance, but the Lord looks at the heart. And I know for me, and I know for all of you too, my outward appearance, the way I interact with you, the way I interact with my family or my colleagues, the way I react to stressful situations, they're a result of where my heart posture is toward God and toward myself and my life. But what man can see is only the outward appearance, how I'm interacting with people. But what God can see is what's in the heart. And so as Christians, I think, and as people, we're constantly faced with this conversation of how does the outward appearance reflect what's going on deep inside. And this is actually an important topic in science as well. It's often called complexity theory or measurement theory, and it's what I study at a high level. So in biology and in all of life, human bodies and physiology is made up of scales. So we start on this small scale, and then interactions within those scales then create the larger scale, and create the larger scale to cells, and then we get organoids, and eventually we get the human body. Interactions are within these scales often are important and studied, but I think what we need to remember is that interactions within those scales influence how the next scale is created or emerges. What's also important is that not only is the emergent, the smaller scales influencing the larger scales, but the larger scales influence the smaller scales. So a typical example is stem cell research, where the type of cell or environment that that cell is around is going to influence what the cell ends up becoming. I'm going to argue that disease is essentially something within these scales and interactions going wrong. And so in medicine, the diagnostic part of medicine is trying to figure out what is going wrong across these scales. But in medicine, especially with the exception of genomics or personalized or precision medicine, typically we can't actually see these scales. What we have is typically a measurement of some of the larger scales or the result of many, 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 many processes that result in emergence. So for example, blood pressure is not for the physicists in the room, pressure is not a result of something physical, it's the result of many physical interactions. And so my research at a very high level is finding computational mechanisms to map measurements of physiology back onto the underlying physiology that's impaired. And we can do that using by exploiting the fact that oftentimes these scales act on temporal dimensions, and we can look at the different time scales underlying these scales. And I'm going to talk about two ways that I do this in my PhD dissertation. One is communication within the pancreatic islet in the context of diabetes care, and the second is looking at vascular regulation in the context of stroke in the neuro ICU. So, diabetes is a pervasive problem in the United States. We think 1 in 10 people have diabetes, and probably 1 in 3 people in the United States have pre-diabetes. So it's a massive problem that we're struggling with. But as Christians, I believe that we should not only be looking at the United States, but the whole world. And what I want you to notice is that lower income and lower middle income countries have a rapid increase in diabetes in the last few years, and we need to be able to look at this problem from a holistic perspective. Diabetes is describing the physiological process that involves glucose homeostasis. And beta cells are cells that are central to diabetes and glucose homeostasis. So essentially what happens is if I eat food or for some other reason my blood glucose increases, cells within the pancreatic islet called beta cells sense that increase in blood glucose and secrete a hormone called insulin. And that insulin moves into the bloodstream and moves throughout the body and triggers muscle and adipose tissues to uptake that glucose and decrease your blood glucose and also allow those organs to function. Diabetes is the process for which the amount of insulin secreted is not adequate to allow this process to happen. And so beta cells are really central. So as I just said, beta cells produce insulin in response to high glucose. But beta cells also have heterogeneous intrinsic dynamics. And so when you take an islet or a conglomeration of beta cells and other cells and you dissociate them and you give them different amounts of glucose, what you can see is that some beta cells start secreting insulin at low levels of glucose and other beta cells start secreting insulin at high levels of glucose. And so they're heterogeneous in their intrinsic dynamics. And in line with the conference theme, you could also say they're diverse in the way that they act. However, they don't act alone. They're not dissociated in real life. They act together and they communicate through what are called gap junctions, which are these protein channels for which ions can move through. So what I want you to see on the top level, in order to measure beta cell activity, we do something called calcium microscopy, where we look at the calcium fluorescence as a proxy for insulin secretion or beta cell activity. And on the top, you can see the beta cells are secreting together in a pulsatile manner through gap junctions in a normal mouse. When we knock out the beta cell, the gap junctions through genetic modification, you can see that that secreted pulsatile insulin is impaired. And interestingly, the coordinated dynamics and gap junctions are lost in diabetes, so it's important to understand the role of heterogeneity in driving islet dynamics. But this is really hard because, again, in line with the talk this morning, you can't, in order to look at the way they're communicating, you can't take the islet apart. You have to somehow be able to look at the unity and how they're working together while also looking at their individual pieces. And so we do this in, one way we can do this in a quantitative fashion is through what's called network theory. And so this is a video showing a calcium microscopy of the islet. And what I do is these blue dots represent each cell, and I draw what's called an edge between cells if they're highly synchronized with each other. And then we can use that network or the amount of edges that each cell has, which is called the degree, to quantitatively understand more about the ways that the beta cells interact. And what has been found in the past is that some cells have very high degree or they're synchronized with a lot of the islet, and they're called hub cells or beta cell hubs. So there becomes this question, what drives beta cell hubs? And why might you care about that? Because in the context of diabetes care, if we knew what drove these cells that are highly synchronized, we might be able to exploit that mechanistic information to influence coordination and perhaps influence insulin secretion. So the goal of this paper, this study, was to quantify the relationship between structure, which is gap junctions, function, which is these emergent synchronization processes, and the intrinsic dynamics or metabolic dynamics of the cells. And we do that first by looking at beta cell hubs compared to the rest of the islet. And then we zoom out and look at the entire islet as a network. And if you don't really care about the biology, maybe another way to think about this is what matters more when I'm looking at how to influence community. Is it the internal dynamics, or what I would say is the heart posture, or is it the physical influence, my conversations with you, or the amount of connections that I have? So we'll kind of keep that in the back of our minds as we're going through the results. So the way we do this is through both calcium microscopy and computational modeling. So our computational model is basically a mathematical representation of the beta cell, where we have electrical analog for the different channels and whatnot. And then we take those ordinary differential equations and we pair them together to make a 1,000 beta cell islet, simulated islet. And what you can see on the bottom right is that these simulated islets secrete have a nice calcium oscillations. And then what we can do is we can increase the heterogeneity of their intrinsic dynamics, or the diversity of the cells. So that's the glucokinase rate, or KGlyc. And we can also increase the changes in their structural connectivity. And then we can simulate it forward, we can extract the functional network, and we can extract hubs versus non-hubs. Then we can look back and say what parameters within the model allowed these cells to be hubs or non-hubs. And what I want you to see is that the structural connections, the gap junctions, have some relationship between determining hubs or non-hubs, but what really seems to matter are the intrinsic metabolic rate. So intrinsic dynamics seems to influence hubs more than non-hubs. If we want to look at this through an experimental lens, we take the islet and we can do calcium imaging to extract the functional network and the calcium dynamics. And then we can also stain for the intrinsic metabolic rate, which is the NADPH. And we can do something called FRAP, or fluorescence recovery after photo bleaching, to get an idea of the gap junction connectivity. And again, experimentally, we see that the intrinsic dynamics are essential for determining hubs, but the structural connections are not as important. And so we know that the subpopulations of beta cells, so these hubs, seem to be determined by intrinsic dynamics more than structural connections. If we zoom out then and we look at the entire islet, what I want you to see first, this is from the computational lens, if we just look at one cell in the functional network, in blue are all the other cells that it's synchronized to, in red are the cells that it's structurally connected to, and in black is the overlap. And what you can see is, regardless of whether it's highly synchronized, not synchronized at all, or somewhere in between, there's not a lot of black on the top, which means that, again, structure and function aren't directly related to each other. Alternatively, if we look at the metabolic network or the intrinsic dynamics, you see that there's a lot of black, meaning there's more relationship. And we can quantitatively analyze this by looking at the marginal conditional probabilities. See, the probability of gap junctions or structure given the synchronization is small, but the probability that they're metabolically connected is large. So the scientific implications of this is that the islet seems to be robust to perturbations because it's the intrinsic dynamics rather than structural connections that drive these hubs and the whole synchronization. But also, I think there's an implication that as we increase diversity, it allows robustness in our communities. The heart posture implications of this finding is that it seems like the internal dynamics are more important in influencing community than physical influence. And while that might seem counterintuitive, you can think about the fact that if I have a lot of connections with people, I'm very highly networked, but I have weak internal dynamics or a weak conviction, I'm going to become a follower and not a leader. And so that's an interesting takeaway from a heart posture perspective. Now I'm going to switch into a new topic that I've been working on and I'm excited about, where we're looking, instead of diabetes, we're starting to look at stroke and traumatic brain injury from a similar lens, and particularly in the context of neurocritical care. And I'm calling this cerebrovascular measurements and underlying physiology, or we can think about this as looking at the difference between observation or the heart. So blood flow in the brain is essential for you to be able to survive. And in your brain, blood flow moves because of a pressure gradient and the radius of the vasculature. And that radius is fine-tunedly changing based on these three mechanisms that allow you to always have the blood flow you need. And these mechanisms, called cerebrovascular tone regulation, can be impaired in injury or because of previous disease, and it's associated with worse outcomes following traumatic brain injury or stroke. And so if clinicians knew the functionality of these mechanisms, it's possible that they'd be a key therapeutic target. but they're not measurable clinically. And that's particularly because the normal way that we measure it, besides some kind of genetic knockout, which is impossible to do or unethical to do in humans, is by adding this large perturbation to the patient's physiology. And neurocritical care patients are unstable, and you can't do that. It would be very dangerous. So the long-term goal of this research project is to develop a physics-informed type machine learning approach to estimate CVTR function for clinical decision support. And the way we do this is we take advantage of the fact that we understand cerebral hemodynamics at some kind of level, and we can take that understanding and mathematize it. And so this is the mathematical representation of this model. And unfortunately, I don't have time to get into the machine learning portion, but the preliminary results of these findings, but I can have time to validate the model. And so basically what we do is we take this model and we run it with experimental data and see if they match. So this is experimental data that's meant to test the myogenic mechanism. And what you can see is it does pretty terrible with no cerebrovascular tone regulation, which is what you'd hope. If you add the myogenic mechanism only, it does okay. But what's interesting is if I add all the mechanisms, the model does quite well. In a different situation where we're trying to test endothelial-related vascular regulation, if we add endothelial only, which is in the center, it does okay. But if we add all of them, it does really well. And so the conclusions of this is now we have a validated differential equation-based model underlying cerebrovascular tone regulation, and what I haven't shown is that we've integrated this into a mechanistic machine learning approach that seems to be promising for estimating this for clinical decision support. But in a heart posture perspective, what we see is that the observed dynamics are a result of so much more than the single mechanism we're perturbing. And I have a 10-month-old daughter, and so we can all attest to the fact that if she, you know, pulls the electrical cord out of the outlet, my response is not a direct representation of the fact that the electrical cord is out of the outlet. It's a direct representation of where my heart posture is at the time and my emotional status. And so I think it's really cool that we see this in physiology as well, that even though you're trying to perturb the myogenic mechanism, so many other mechanisms are working together to stabilize this system. That it's just like our hearts toward God. So I'll remind you of this idea, does not see as man sees, for man looks at the outward appearance, but the Lord looks at the heart. And this remembrance in our Christian lives that we need to be constantly aware of the fact that when we're interacting with other people, we do not have the ability to see the internal things that are going on. We can only see the external. And so as Christians, I think our job is to try to see more as God sees and to be prayerful in that way. And as scientists, to remember that every time you measure anything, there's a mapping process between what's actually going on and what you're measuring. And so just to be cognizant of the fact that that mapping process is also influencing how you look at the system. So as a shameless plug, I'm actively searching for next steps in my career opportunity. So if you're interested in this research at all, I would love to chat. But how does this science influence our relationship with God? The internal dynamics, our heart posture, even scientifically and quantitatively, it seems that they're important for influencing community more than our physical influence. And the observed dynamics are a result of so much more than just a single mechanism we're perturbing. So, yeah, thank you. Love to take questions.
Thank you very much for your presentation. When you said you were doing machine learning modeling, I just wanted to jump up and cheer. What occurred to me, and what I'd like you to comment on, is it appears to me that when you have a limited set of metrics that you can use to infer for the much lower scale items that are going on, the vast amount of research that's already in the bag and measurements all the way in the bag would make a tremendous body to leverage that kind of tool, specifically because the weakness of machine learning is you're always data starved. So could you please comment on if or how you're looking at that? Thank you.
Yeah, thanks. That's like the bread and butter of what we're doing. So it's really exciting. So In typical machine learning, essentially you give the machine a lot of data, and that data, and then you kind of ask the machine to fit a functional form of the prediction to that data. But before the 1970s, when these types of processes were coming about, all of you guys were figuring out all of the physical laws underlying these scenarios. So what mechanistic machine learning or data simulation, or what's recently been called like digital twins, does is it takes the physical laws and basically constrains the machine learning to live within the laws of physics. And that allows us to use less data, which data are extremely limited in healthcare settings. So it allows us to use less data to have accurate predictions. But it also allows the predictions based on the machine to have a physiological or physics-based grounding that we can then tell the clinician, this is why the machine is making that prediction. So we think it's really powerful. Yeah.
Oh, great. Excellent talk, Jennifer. Just following up with your comment about the measuring the cardiovascular. And you were mentioning, of course, it's unethical to do a knockout in humans. Have you considered using like a mouse model to do a knockout, or maybe a protein biomarker, like a vascular marker of some kind? And would that be a more efficient way to do your research?
Yeah, absolutely. So now that we have this machinery, the idea is to validate it. And this machinery is all developed in the context of being used in clinical care. So protein markers and asking a clinician to gain or to measure any more data than they can just removes the ability for us to move forward. So what this allows is to use only the measurements that are already collected to gain new information. But in order to validate this, we have to use some kind of models. So mouse models don't work very well for vasculature, cerebral vasculature to humans. So I'm hoping to use pig models, mm-hmm. and then definitely correlating against biomarkers.
Oh, and just do they do pig knockouts? I didn't know if they actually do.
Yeah, I don't know if they do pig knockouts, but they do pig models of vasculature that you can block receptors and things like that. Yeah, thanks for asking. Yeah.
Hi, Jennifer, great talk. Have you interacted with anyone in communication science, scholarship in communication, where they're dealing with human interactions to really take your ideas a step further from sort of a metaphorical connection to an actual like, wow, these two things are very similar?
Yeah, I haven't, but maybe I should. It'd be fun. Thanks, Steve.
Last question.
Thanks for your talk. I have a biological question about islets.
Yeah.
I'm assuming they're not all the same size.
Yes.
And so my question really is, what determines two things, the size of the islets, and does the size have an effect on the emergent interactions, or do the interactions have effect on the size?
Gosh, this is such a good question. And this is a question that we're The short answer is we don't know, because interestingly, unlike like the brain that scales size in organisms, mice have much smaller brains than elephants. The size of the islet is actually quite there's very small variation across organisms. So that implies from a complexity theory perspective that the size is limited by the synchronization ability. Currently, so we think that it's the number of beta cells are perfectly tuned, maybe by a creator, to allow synchronization. But we're trying to study that by like making fake islets that are too big, because right now they don't exist. There's just not a very big difference in that organism size.
Hey, thank you again.